and then go to sleep.
Yes, that's also another point. But you know, sometimes they have to be awake at night, so they...
Why? Because modern day life is dragging us.
No, sometimes they're writing a book, maybe.
This scholar says, the only thing that I regret in my life is sleepless nights. And why a scholar will have sleepless nights? Obviously,
you know,
to study.
There is no deny that modern life has changed us.
Of course.
Except that you take me into a place where there is no electricity, where there is no net, and I have to go through my plans. Like,
alhamdulillah,
back in times.
We have so much that in Kashmir. We have
so much that beautiful.
In the Indian occupied Kashmir. We have, I mean, we have curfews, we have internet going down, and people get to see each other at least.
Yes. Yeah. Don't go anywhere, we'll join you in a minute.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
So let's go back to reality with today's discussion. You know, when we go to travel to some remote places, we understand how beautiful life could be.
Exactly.
If there is no attachments, if there is no net, if there is not much
No attachment to modern life, actually.
Yes, no attachment to modern life.
Yeah. And physical beings also exist.
And searching for money. What are the other side effects of modern life in your viewpoint?
The stress, that mental, you know, where you're overwhelmed with
work. The pressure you feel.
Yeah. So I feel like sometimes I get so overwhelmed. There's so much to do. People expect so much from you.
Yes.
Especially when you're in the house, right?
Yes.
But I'm still optimistic about it. That during, like in 20 years or 40 years, that there will be some kind of, let's say, an academic revolution inside the house. Which really helps it. And then, you know, really help the other side to come as well.
I think aside from being optimistic, we have to be realistic.
That is true.
Yes.
I cannot deny that. Sorry.
Surrendered.
No, I surrendered because really,
yeah. You, Sister Zainab, other side effects that comes to your mind when we talk about modernity?
I think you're losing each and every moment, like Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Surah Inshiqaq, I guess, tabaqan and tabak. Time is passing. Every second is passing. Every minute is going. You are in a journey. But he gives us a wake-up call in that surah. Look at your journey. Look at your path. May you not be among the people who receive their book of deeds from the backside. Just be among, try to be in this journey that is going on, that's going on in this journey. Be among the people who are going to receive the book of deeds from the right side. We are losing this each and every second that is going, that is passing, without even noticing ourselves. You know, I think the worst thing of it, the worst part of this is it has disconnected us physically.
Mm-hmm.
Disconnected family members physically, disconnected parents, disconnected, I don't know, even husband and wife live under one roof.
Yes,
but at the same time,
they're not together. They have their cell phones in their hands.
Exactly.
And they're not speaking to each other.
Exactly. I think the best way to treat that is to, you know, give more time to your parents. Just throw your phone. When you go to your home, just throw your phone away. Just
that's very hard to do.
Just shut down the doorway. If you do that yourself, you can make your partner or you can make your parents or, you know, daughters, sisters, whosoever is in your phone, you can make them shut down your phone. But once you do that yourself, once you do not use yourself, then only you can suggest anyone else in the family, like, let's not do this. Or you have to come up with the recreational ideas yourself.
Yeah.
You have to cook something beautiful and tell them, like, you know, cook something tasty. Tell them, let's go to park and eat it there.
Yes, have some new experiences in your life.
All right. Usually when the husband and the wife are okay with each other, this happens. Usually when there are no problems in life, your ideas are very clear and very good. But the thing is, sometimes people run away from the reality by social media, by going into electricity. It's a way to actually... It's actually a way to run away.
So instead of
run away from what?
Problems, they fall into...
So what was your question, basically?
My question is that, what do these people who are running away from their life, they don't want that physical, you know, environment that they're living in.
You have to get them back to life. That's why...
Back to reality.
Back to reality.
So they listen to the show?
Here we are to bring them back to reality.
Yeah, that's why we are discussing this here.
I think that sometimes people run away from their, you know, physical life.
Yeah.
towards the virtual life for this.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
You know, I've heard it a lot, and we've seen this a lot, especially in, you know, like entertainment. The reason why entertainment is so dragging, it's like a magnet, it's because it has that, you know, power to make you forget about your life. It makes you live a, you know, a fake life. Like even when you're supporting a football team,
yeah,
for 90 minutes, that ball in the middle of the field is your life. If it goes into that net, you're the happiest person in the world. Mm-hmm. If it goes in your net, then you're the worst person in the world. You feel so empty. You feel so, you know, depressed. And we've seen people forget about their sicknesses and their health issues, watching sports, watching entertainment. Some people, you know, listen to music and cry. I'm not telling you guys listen to music. I'm just saying that some people do that. Right. So I think that physical, sometimes, you know, telling people to throw away your phones and run into physical interference might not be the best answer.
Even if you're, you know, gaining so much on the, you know, internet life, the modern life, whatever the stuff you're using, I cannot forget these hadiths, these narrations which say the moment to believers shake their hands, Allah's blessings keep on showering mm-hmm. until they get separated
from
each other.
That's one example. We also have the example of, you know, looking at your wife in a good way, your wife looking at you in a good way, and then, for example, playing with your children.
We don't have that today, you know.
But also, there's this idea that sometimes Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam are telling us to do this. It's recommended in Islam, even though we don't like it. We have to keep that in mind. So telling people to throw away their phones, you know, it's not going to be the easiest of things. There are some people who have family members that they don't like, but yet they still continue to have a connection with them. Why? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala ordered that.
Yeah.
So you cannot tell that person who is sitting down in the family gathering, all right, throw your phone, be happy with the family. The person's trying to run away. I think that we should implant it in a different way, in a different manner.
We're talking about the side effects of modernity and the effects that it has brought to our lives. We talked about so many things. We said that we are getting less of a sleep. We're having too much of a stress and there's so much of pressure. Maybe part of it is virtual and not needed, but it has been imposed to our lives. And you've given us some very cool advices and recommendations. So thank you for listening to us. Until another session, we bid you farewell. I leave you to the protection of God's never sleeping eyes.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Erubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters. British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator Ofcom asking it to review RT's license to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik, as well as their subsidiaries, will no longer be able to spread their lies to justify Putin's war and to sow division in our union.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms. This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech. The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship, and the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy, and that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
Palestinians in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets in support of more than 4,500 prisoners who are facing strict punitive measures and collective punishment by Israeli prison authorities. Recently, the prisoners have taken a series of actions against new restrictions imposed on them by Israeli authorities. Prisoners' advocacy groups who organized the protest described the prisoners' actions as an uprising or intifada.
I prefer to call it the prisoners' intifada or uprising because the inmates face daily assault caused by the prison administration, who is seeking to destroy their collective efforts over the years that aim to improve living conditions in detention.
Tensions in Israeli prisons have escalated since September 2021, following the escape of six prisoners from the Gilboa High Security Jail. Although they were caught after a massive manhunt, Israeli officials implemented several punitive measures against the remaining detainees, such as banning visits and reducing their yard time, which led to clashes and strikes.
The prisoners are our red line. We will not allow prison authorities to cross it, and we will not remain silent on these punitive measures against our freedom fighters. And we know at the end of the day they will achieve victory as they did in previous battles. The prison administration knows very well what it's doing will only lead to more tension.
As part of those actions taken by the prisoners since January the 1st, some 500 detainees have been boycotting the Israeli military court system to protest their imprisonment under the so-called administrative detention. Today, some 4,500 Palestinians are held in Israeli prisons, including 180 children and 34 women. Palestinians hail them as freedom fighters.
Prisoners' advocacy groups say 2022 has been worse for the Palestinian prisoners so far, and the inmates themselves believe that they are in need of such solidarity protests because the worst is yet to come in the wake of the escalating tough measures by the Israeli prison authorities. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Following the recent retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army and its aerial strikes on Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, the United Nations Security Council imposed an arms embargo on Yemen's Ansarullah movement. This measure was proposed by the UAE in an attempt to curtail the military capabilities of the Yemeni army.
Arms embargo on Yemen is not new. As everyone knows, we are prohibited from even buying fuel, foodstuffs. Today, Yemenis are suffering from a severe fuel crisis due to the seizure of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The Yemeni army depends on the Yemeni military industries, which have proven to the world the growing military capabilities of Yemen. This resolution will not stop the Yemeni missile attacks, but rather will prompt the Yemeni army to intensify its retaliatory operations.
In a Twitter post, the member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, criticized the measure, saying it has ignored war crimes by the Saudi-led coalition. He noted that any arms embargo that does not apply to the Western-backed coalition has no value.
The Security Council's resolution will not affect Yemen in facing the Saudi-led war. The Yemeni army continues to make progress on all battlefronts, and this measure is only aimed at satisfying Saudi Arabia and its allies. The resolution also aims to prolong the war on Yemen and halt any move toward peace. We, as the Yemeni people, are besieged. Our airports and ports are closed, and we cannot buy weapons like other countries. So this decision will not have any effect.
Saudi Arabia's allies have launched a deadly war on Yemen since the beginning of 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, many of them women and children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to escalate its retaliatory attacks against Saudi and Emirati territories.
Experts say the Yemeni army depends on local military industries in addition to the spoils of war left by the Saudi-led coalition's forces after escaping the battlefronts. They believe that the UN resolution will make no difference as Yemen is besieged by Saudi Arabia since the beginning of the war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Images may soon be a thing of the past if Brussels has its way and removes Russian-backed media RT and Sputnik and their subsidiaries from the airwaves. British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator Ofcom asking it to review RT's license to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship. And the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy. And that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that, really. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine. These kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this massive disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time, but observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
The Prophet of Mercy, a sequel to the 2015 letters written by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to the Western youth in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, imploring them to learn about the Muslim faith from its original sources.
And one of the key things in the book he talks about is education.
And when you have education, you're able to talk to somebody, even if you don't agree with their point of view, but at least you can converse with them. And I think that with the lack of education, lack of respect for somebody else, or lack of understanding of somebody else's point of view, results in violence or results in people taking the law into their own hands. We don't want that.
Translated into multiple languages, the 196-page book elaborates on the life of Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam.
I think the book is trying to say to us, we need to relook at his life in the manner looking at social cohesion, looking at the concept of brotherhood, looking at the concept of unity, looking at the concept of how we should resolve our problems together.
1,400 years ago, Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and went on to change the course of history. For 1.5 billion Muslims, he is the last and greatest of that long line of prophets who have brought the Word of God to humanity. Today, Islam and its followers are on the receiving end of some of the most vicious attacks, all for the appalling acts of a few.
It is quite overt, and the paradox that Muslims are often accused of terrorism, whereas they're in fact amongst the prime victims of terrorism. Because they do get attacked by fanatics and extremists all the time.
Prophet Muhammad laid the foundation for the religion of Islam, that after his death developed a culture and civilization that spread around the world, inspiring hundreds of millions. At a time when many in the West, under the influence of the mainstream media, see Islam as a violent, intolerant faith, it is hoped that publications such as this one will shed light on true Islam and win hearts and minds. Saeed Purizab, London.
He is referred to as the head of ambassadors in Iran. Salah al-Zawawi has retired after completing his 40th year as the Palestinian ambassador to Iran. He finished his tenure in January when he was succeeded by his daughter, Salam al-Zawawi. Here at the Tehran office of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the former Palestinian envoy was honored for his 4 decades of activities. Following the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran ended its alliance with Israel and officially recognized Palestine as a state. This was followed by shutting down the Israeli embassy in Tehran and turning it over to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Al-Zawawi was among a delegation headed by then PLO chief Yasser Arafat, who came to Iran days after the revolution and symbolically took over the keys of the embassy. Al-Zawawi is one of the founding members of Fatah political party and the second Palestinian ambassador to Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He has held the post since 1981. And before that, he served as the Palestinian ambassador to Algeria, Brazil, and Kenya. Throughout his career, Al-Zawawi took major steps to shed light on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which has been ongoing for more than 7 decades.
After 4 decades of serving as Palestine's envoy to Iran, Salah al-Zawawi is now retiring. But unlike any other ambassador, he's not going to live his retired life in his home country, as he's one of the millions of Palestinian diaspora who are denied the right to return to their homeland. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
If passed, the Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK government the power to jail asylum seekers for up to 4 years if they arrive via sea routes like the English Channel, and others could be sent to a third country for processing and detention. The devolved nations Scotland and Wales have already rejected it as an anti-refugee bill, and people on the streets of London are demanding Westminster do the same.
They're putting legislation in protest in place so that they can put guns on our beaches. That's what they want to do, because the migrants that will be coming when the climate and the ecological emergency really begins to hit, we want to welcome and they want to keep out.
Britain's banks, its military, its companies across the world creating poverty, creating destruction and warfare, and when people try to flee from the consequences of that, Britain puts up fences, borders, guards to keep people out.
The bill also gives the government extraordinary powers when it comes to ethnic minorities in the UK.
A proposed rule change quietly added to the bill will give the Home Secretary draconian powers over immigrants, first, second and third generation alike.
The fact of the matter is you can be born and bred legally in the UK, but if you have dual citizenship or can claim citizenship somewhere else, the British government might give itself permission to strip you of your British citizenship. In short, you're not British enough. You're a second-class citizen.
Once you are a citizen, you have the right to remain a citizen. I mean, there's many incidents. That young woman in Syria, that's such an important precedent. They groomed her. She should be brought home. She should be looked after. This is, in any other situation, this would be considered child abuse.
Shamima Begum was 15 years old when she left the UK for Syria, where she was absorbed by the Daesh terrorist group. As a second-generation Bangladeshi, she has been stripped of her citizenship and is still languishing in a Syrian refugee camp.
These are the most racist pieces of legislation we've seen in the UK in modern British history. They constitute a direct infringement on every minority's rights, giving the right for a politician to take away our citizenship and giving the government overwhelming power to decide immigration policy. We're resisting today, we'll resist tomorrow, and we invite the country to resist alongside us.
Under the new bill, the government would no longer have to inform someone they are about to lose their citizenship. This will make appealing the decision almost impossible. Rights groups say these measures are used mainly against British Muslims, but Black and Asian Britons also say they now live in fear. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Sunday, the 27th of February, has been described as a major turning point for the EU. Including fighter jets, the 27-country bloc is going to send deadly military hardware to Ukraine, which will be used against Russian forces.
For the first time ever, the European Union will finance the purchase and delivery of weapons and other equipment to a country that is under attack.
The EU has always labelled itself as a peace project. Analysts are now questioning this.
They release huge funds to buy these lethal weapons from their own industries and to supply belligerent groups to continue the conflict. I think it's absolutely shocking and it's funeral of the European project as such, because it's not more a project of peace.
Another package of sanctions against Russia and Belarus were agreed by EU foreign affairs ministers on Sunday. Some Russian banks are being blocked from the SWIFT financial payment system.
This degree of disconnection is carefully calibrated in order to create the maximum damage to the financial system of Russia.
EU airspace is being closed to all Russian aircraft, and Russian media outlets, including RT, are being banned from broadcasting in the 27-nation bloc. Also on Sunday, EU Home Affairs ministers met to discuss support for member states Poland, Slovakia, Hungary and Romania, which have witnessed flows of asylum seekers.
We have already seen more than 300,000 Ukrainians are fleeing the country, coming to the European Union.
Meanwhile, all eyes are now on the Kremlin to see how it might respond to this latest set of measures. The EU is clearly taking a calculated risk by providing deadly weapons to Ukraine. But could this lead to the crisis spiralling completely out of control? EU citizens will be hoping the risk has not been miscalculated by the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After months of suspension, Afghan public universities have reopened. We visited Kabul University and spoke with a number of teachers and students. They say they're happy returning to the campus and hope good educational days are ahead.
We are very happy that we have returned to university again. We have been away from our classes and lessons for almost 7 months. I was longing for this day so much. This new beginning and opportunity can motivate us and give more hope for the future.
It is a big day for the young generation. The opening of the doors of universities could open the doors of developments. I hope this process continues well. I urge the international community to help our higher education sector and poor families so that their sons and daughters can get education.
Male and female students are returning to Kabul University, but in different shifts. Moreover, new roles and changes are brought by the new directors.
Actually, I witnessed a lot of changes in Kabul University. First, some departments in the fine art faculty like cinema, music, and theater are said to be cancelled. Secondly, students are obliged to change their outfits. Girls should come in the morning and boys in the afternoon. In addition, we didn't find most of our former teachers and there were new figures.
Some experts say it's not all about reopening, and there are many challenges left on the way of higher education in Afghanistan.
A huge number of our scholars, professors, and lecturers left our country during the government change. This has caused a significant loss in our higher education institutions. We need them back now. Furthermore, the Taliban government are going to make changes in universities' educational syllabuses and staff. It's uncertain where the Taliban are leading our higher education.
Like most public universities, Kabul University had closed in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban takeover. Formerly, the university had remained shut for some months due to COVID-19 pandemic. The reopening of universities have brought hope to the younger generation in Afghanistan. The students here say this process must be supported in advance so that they can continue their education this year successfully. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Researchers say the explosion of plastic production in the past 70 years from 2 million tons to 380 million tons a year had given microbes time to evolve to deal with plastic. We're prepared an article written by Damien Carrington. The piece is titled "Study Find Bugs Across the Globe Are Evolving to Eat Plastic." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to the study, microbes in oceans and soils across the globe are evolving to eat plastic. The research scanned more than 200 million genes found in DNA. Samples taken from the environment and found 30,000 different enzymes that could degrade 10 different types of plastic. The study is the first large-scale global assessment of the plastic degrading potential of bacteria and found that 1 in 4 of the organisms analyzed carried a suitable enzyme. The researchers found that the number and type of enzymes they discovered matched the amount and type of plastic pollution in different locations. The scientists said the results provided evidence of a measurable effect of plastic pollution on the global microbial ecology. Millions of tons of plastic are dumped in the environment every year, and the pollution now pervades the planet, from the summit of Mount Everest to the deepest oceans. Reducing the amount of plastic used is vital, as is the proper collection and treatment of waste. But many plastics are currently hard to degrade and recycle. Using enzymes to rapidly break down plastics into their building blocks would enable new products to be made from old ones, cutting the need for virgin plastic production. The new research provides many new enzymes to be investigated and adapted for industrial use. Professor Alexei Selezniak at Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden said, "We've found multiple lines of evidence supporting the fact that the global microbiome's plastic degrading potential correlates strongly with measurements of environmental plastic pollution, a significant demonstration of how the environment is responding to the pressures we're placing on it." Jan Zrimek, also at Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden, said, "We did not expect to find such a large number of enzymes across so many different microbes and environmental habitats. This is a surprising discovery that really illustrates the scale of the issue." The explosion of plastic production in the past 70 years, from 2 million tons to 380 million tons a year, had given microbes time to evolve to deal with plastic, the researchers said. The study, published in the journal Microbial Ecology, started by compiling a dataset of 95 microbial enzymes already known to degrade plastic, often found in bacteria in rubbish dumps and similar places rife with plastic. The team then looked for similar enzymes in environmental DNA samples taken by other researchers from 236 different locations across the world. Importantly, the researchers ruled out potential false positives by comparing the enzymes initially identified with enzymes from the human gut, which is not known to have any plastic-degrading enzymes. About 12,000 of the new enzymes were found in the ocean samples, taken at 67 locations and at 3 different depths. The results showed consistently higher levels of degrading enzymes at deeper levels in the ocean, matching the higher levels of plastic pollution known to exist at lower depths. The soil samples were taken from 169 locations in 38 countries and 11 different habitats and contained 18,000 plastic-degrading enzymes. Soils are known to contain more plastics with phthalate additives than the oceans, and the researchers found more enzymes that attack these chemicals in the land samples. The scientists said nearly 60% of the new enzymes did not fit into any known enzyme classes, suggesting these molecules degrade plastics in ways that were previously unknown. Professor Selezniak said the next step would be to test the most promising enzyme candidates in the laboratory to closely investigate their properties and the rate of plastic degradation that they can achieve. He added, "From there, you could engineer microbial communities with targeted degrading functions for specific polymer types." The first bug that eats plastic was discovered in a Japanese waste dump in 2016. Scientists then tweaked it in 2018 to try to learn more about it and how it evolved, but inadvertently they created an enzyme that was even better at breaking down plastic bottles. Further tweaks in 2020 increased the speed of degradation sixfold. Another mutant enzyme was created in 2020 by the company Carbios that breaks down plastic bottles for recycling in hours. German scientists have also discovered the bacterium that feeds on the toxic plastic polyurethane, which is usually dumped in landfills. Recently, scientists revealed that levels of microplastics known to be eaten by people via their food cause damage to human cells in the laboratory. The study has found microplastics cause damage to human cells in the laboratory at the levels known to be eaten by people via their food. The harm included cell death and allergic reactions, and the research is the first to show this happens at levels relevant to human exposure. However, the health impact to the human body is uncertain because it is not known how long microplastics remain in the human body before being excreted. As we mentioned, microplastic pollution has contaminated the entire planet, from the summit of Mount Everest to the deepest of oceans. People were already known to consume the tiny particles via their food and water, as well as breathing them in. The research analyzed 17 previous studies which looked at the toxicological impacts of microplastics on human cell lines. The scientists compared the level of microplastics at which damage was caused to the cells with the levels consumed by people through contaminated drinking water, contaminated seafood, and table salt. They found specific types of harm, cell death, allergic response, and damage to cell walls were caused by the levels of microplastics that people ingest. Evangelos Donopoulos, the Hull York Medical School in the United Kingdom, and who led the research published in the Journal of Hazardous Materials, said, "Harmful effects on cells are in many cases the initiating event for health effects." He added, "We should be concerned. Right now, there isn't really a way to protect ourselves." He said future research could make it possible to identify the most contaminated foods and avoid them, but the ultimate solution was to stop the loss of plastic waste. Once the plastic is in the environment, we can't really get it out. Research on the health impact of microplastics is ramping up quickly. Evangelos Donopoulos of the Hull York Medical School said, "It is exploding, and for good reason. We are exposed to these particles every day. We're eating them, we're inhaling them, and we don't really know how they react with our bodies once they're in." The research also showed irregularly shaped microplastics cause more cell deaths than spherical ones. This is important for future studies, as many microplastics bought for use in laboratory experiments are spherical and therefore may not be representative of the particles humans ingest. Microplastics researcher Steve Allen said, "This work helps inform where research should be looking to find real-world effects. It was interesting that shape was so important to toxicity, as it confirms what many plastic pollution researchers believed would be happening, that pristine spheres used in laboratory experiments may not be showing the real-world effects." Donopoulos said the next step for researchers was to look at studies of microplastic harm in laboratory animals. Experiments on human subjects would not be ethical. In March, a study showed tiny plastic particles in the lungs of pregnant rats passed rapidly into their hearts, brains and other organs, and even their fetuses. In December, microplastics were revealed in the placentas of unborn babies, which the researchers said was a matter of great concern. In October, scientists showed that babies fed formula milk in plastic bottles were swallowing millions of plastic particles a day.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. As always, I have the honor and pleasure of being joined by my darling sister and special guest, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. How are you, my dear?
I'm very good, thank you. On the previous episodes of Muslim Lady, we've been talking about expectation of a Muslim society, of a Muslim lady. And then the conclusion that we came to was that really, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter who expects what of whom, as long as we expect ourselves to just please God. And we only expect God's satisfaction. And that can only occur through strengthening and nourishing our iman. Otherwise, everything else is just pointless, really. And Sister Razia, you pointed out that a big issue, an impediment that we face, especially today, though I feel that this has always been the case, since Qabil and Habil, materialism was the problem.
Exactly.
You know?
The material world.
Exactly. He bloody killed his brother because of it. But
this
then now
the Quran
changed form.
Continuously just says, "Al-mal wal-banun, zinatul hayat ad-dunya." Be careful so that the glitters of this world will not, you know,
distract you,
exactly.
Blind you.
You're totally right. We have been built. We have been designed in a way.
We have. That's why
our eyes
not
ching ching when you see the dollar.
Drawn toward it, like moth towards fire. That's how we've been designed. That's why it's not easy, and that's how it's meant to be. Otherwise, he wouldn't have said that you are ashraf al-makhluqat. You're higher than my angels. You're higher than all that I've ever created, because you've been wired to want this pot of gold. But then you fight against yourself to want something that you can't even see because you have faith in me, right? That's what makes it such a big deal. And then we're talking about basic needs and whether or not they are considered as materialism, because we want to define where we're standing as a Muslim woman and whether it's in the direction of Allah's satisfaction.
And these days that we have the corona, Omicron, that is going on, and if you have a weak
immune system,
then you're gone.
Exactly.
So you really need to,
nourish yourself.
One point that I wanted to share with you, I just had some instances of how some women were so selfless and so sincere at the time of the revolution. Because it was the anniversary of the
43rd, mashallah.
Anniversary of the
Islamic Revolution of Iran.
Yeah. And then I remembered, I actually, as a child, I have a very vivid memory in my mind.
Good for you.
The guys had gone to, for the 8-year imposed war. And I do remember women who would go to mosques or who would go to each other's houses, and they would make sweets or food. Or men clothes for the soldiers.
The frontliners.
I actually remember the groups that they gathered together to do something selflessly. You could see sincerity in those days.
Totally.
One. And then, even after the revolution, there are so many camps, so many groups that join together to do something for free. Even we have some dentist friends that once or twice a year they all gather to go to like really far-fetched areas where like there's the poverty has have strict they fix people's teeth for free. And these people I'm talking about, they're like super rich. But sometimes once in a while they just detach themselves from their money, from their comfort, from their wealth, and they go to like really
impoverished areas,
and they try to do this. It's actually, they're doing it for themselves, right? It's like that thing that you need to have once in a while to work on your nafs, to work on your soul, and to leash
like
it back.
It's spiritual food, really.
It's really necessary.
We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
And then one more thing that I wanted to share with you was that where does this sincerity come from? one thing that a government, a Muslim government, a Muslim society should expect from a woman is to have an educated woman.
That's like indisputable.
Exactly. So part of, I'm not talking about any kind of education, to become an engineer, a mine engineer, or to become like to study to be a firefighter, or to study to be an architect. I'm not talking about these kind of sciences, if you study it or not, it's not really going to have that
much
effect.
Make the world a better place.
Exactly, as a woman, right? So I'm talking about knowledge that is either needed by you to become a better individual, or a knowledge that is needed for your society that you have to contribute as a very influential and successful woman in that society. Mm. Some things like to be a teacher, a nurse, a doctor, pediatrician, gynecologist, you know, things like that. University professor. But then comes the story of priorities in life and everything that we're not going to go into.
Yeah, we've already discussed this somewhere in one of our
exactly.
series. Yeah.
And to bring, some people might say that you guys are feminists and you're talking about like this because you're, you know, because of your own wishes and desires and it's just your words. I'm going to back up my idea from the Quran where it says, God will raise up those who have believed from among you and وَالَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْعَلْمَ دَرَجَةً and those of you who have been given knowledge, he's going to raise you in some degrees, in some levels. So knowledge is something that is really praiseworthy, that is considered valuable in the Islamic literature.
It's obligatory in Islam.
Exactly.
Whether you're a man or a woman.
And this is in chapter Mujadala, verse number 11. Or let me back up my idea by another verse from the Noble Quran. This is in chapter Tawbah. Mm. I love this verse mm-hmm. so much. Verse number 122, which means that, and the believers should not all go out to fight.
Uh-huh.
Among you, of every troop of them, a party, and it doesn't say men and women, a party only should go forth, that they who are left behind may gain sound knowledge in religion. Sound knowledge in religion. And that they may warn their folk when they return to them. Mm. So among the type of knowledge that we have to acquire is tafaqquhu fid-din.
The right. do's and don'ts of religion.
Exactly. And the religion has so much to offer.
When you talk about do's and don'ts of religion, our minds quickly go to what nullifies salat, you know, the fiqhi aspect of it, whether it's haram or halal for a woman's ankles to show, can a man shave his beard, what time should we break our fast? What are the things that nullify our fast?
The ahkam.
We forget that Islam's do's and don'ts go beyond that. Islam tells us, don't lie, don't gossip, don't hurt someone's feelings, sure. don't trample upon their rights, don't disturb a bird while it's resting in its nest. Don't fool an animal by pretending you have food in your hand to get it to come to you. Islam tells us to be trustworthy, to be honest, to be loyal. Islam tells us not to break our promises. Islam tells us to be on time. There's a hadith from Rasulullah. His Eminence had an appointment with a random dude. Maybe it wasn't so random. Random for us 1400 years later. He had an appointment with a dude and he was standing where he said he'd be standing. And the sun was striking his face. And his companions came around and they were like, Ya Rasulullah, go stand in the shade. And Rasulullah was like, no, I told the man I'll be waiting for him over here.
Wow. Subhanallah.
This is Islam. You know what I mean?
You touched upon the ethics.
And it's the core of Islam.
Exactly. Which means?
I've been raised, I've been chosen as prophet to complete and perfect ethics.
You mentioned a really valuable point. We're not saying that the ahkam is not important. The sharia is definitely very important.
Yeah, exactly. But they go side by side, hand in hand.
Exactly. Islam always emphasizes the fact that it's a religion of balance.
Exactly.
And moderation.
Yeah.
Do not make a caricature, do not make overemphasize or exaggerate one part of religion and then totally neglect the core, the heart, I mean, the veins of religion, which is ethics. And yeah, and more important than knowing the ethical points in Islam, acting upon them is definitely more important than just knowing them, right? And that is the part that where you have to work on your nafs and you have to tame it. You have to bring it up in a way that it will be within your demand, within your control, right? This is the hardest part of life, where among all the attractions, all the glitters, all the everything that is just trying to pull you away, like you are always at a juncture when it comes to ethics, mm. right? The right and the left, which one to choose, and based on how much you've worked on yourself. And based on what your intention is and what your goal in life is, you decide whether the right or the left-hand side to select, yeah. right? So far, we've mentioned 2 points out of the expectations that it state that an Islamic state should have of women. Number one, mm-hmm. we said sincerity and pure faith, which is common between men and women. The second one, which is also common among men and women, and sometimes throughout history, women have been, they have lacked behind or they have been deprived, is education, proper education. And by education, we mean one part of it is tafaqquh fid-deen, you know, to become an expert in religion and not only the ahkam, but also the ethics.
Mm-hmm.
The third one, Zainab, I believe that one thing which is super, super important is that if you want everything to flow smoothly and if you want to have a proper, strong, well-established society, you need to have a well-established foundation, which is Ma buniya bana'un
family.
Islam.
No, I agree with you 100%.
Habba ilallahi ta'ala min at-tazweej.
Yes, but sometimes...
Marriage, family.
But sometimes the thing is that a woman...
Uh-huh.
cannot have a happy marriage sometimes. Okay. A woman cannot have a happy marriage if she was the product of a broken marriage.
Okay.
I do not dispute with the importance, significance, trivial and irreplaceable role of family. But I'm just saying, honey, family goes back generations, not just the family I'm about to establish. Okay. And that's all the time we have for today's episode. There's so much more to talk about this. I agree with you entirely.
You brought a question
yeah.
that is so controversial.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, I left
program.
You guys at a cliff,
Bye, guys.
Cliffhanger, you know? So you'd be intrigued to join us again in further episodes.
Okay.
Not that our topics are not interesting
but
enough.
But remember your question, though.
Family is important, you guys. And fix past traumas before you get into new relationships. Because if you don't heal, you're going to end up bleeding on someone who didn't cut you.
Zainab, sometimes you don't even know that you're in a trauma until you go to another relationship.
Yeah, of course, no.
That is the time that your traumas come up.
Yeah.
So
I totally agree.
You know,
I'm not saying
when
that
you're in your isolation, when you're just in, you know, you're just you and you in your alone island, mm. you don't even realize that you have these
problems,
messed up personalities.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So you have to get it involved in a family and then fix it at the same time.
No. But the awareness
comes after you are in a relationship, unless you go to a psychologist.
Yeah, that's the awareness I'm
talking
about.
You don't even know you have to go to a psychologist.
No. You always have to go to a psychologist. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. Mm-hmm.
IRIB English Radio.